Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Milan KG2C will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. Also, we offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange-colored type. But if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com, or if it is down, the alternative, live.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. An application is available on our website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try my best to provide an answer, and Milan KG2C will join in. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment and, when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know here or use our email address, tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Milan KG2C. Good evening, Milan.
Good evening, Roy. This is Milan Kilo Golf 2 Charlie. Very glad to be back here, and sorry for missing it last time. Looking forward to tonight's net. I'm sure it will be an interesting one. Back to you, Roy, from Kilo Golf 2 Charlie.
Well, you were sorely missed, Milan. Thank you for coming back to us. And let the fun begin. I will be taking call signs and names. If anyone has any questions or comments, or anything to say on this lovely little technical net tonight.
Oh, this is KE2A with a question.
Okay, KE2A recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list? Okay, Chris, I guess we'll start with your question, and hopefully a little bit later some people will check in with their own question. So what can I do for you tonight, Chris?
Well, it's a little vague, but I've been trying to wrap my head around Smith charts recently, and still don't quite understand how an amateur radio operator, what information they might be able to glean from a Smith chart, and what a Smith chart might, you know, help you visualize that you couldn't understand another way. So it's a broad general question, kind of like Smith charts go. KE2A back to net.
Okay, well, that's a very, very, very big question, and I've been scratching my head for the better part of a couple of years to trying to figure out a good way of describing it in an article where I can actually use illustration. To explain it all on the radio without a single illustration, that would be no mean trick.
I understand. I guess, you know, the question is really like what's the primary advantage of a Smith chart, that you know, what information can it give you that you can't get, you know, through some other way of looking at the same data, if that makes sense?
Perfect sense. The point of the Smith chart, and a little bit of the answer to this statement that you just made, is there are other ways of getting there. There's more than one road that gets you to the right destination. And there are different pathways to get there, but it's all the same destination. A Smith chart is a means of encoding the information of what a complex impedance is. A complex impedance is a bunch of things. It is a resistance, a pure resistance, like a resistor has, that is indifferent to whatever frequency current you give it. If you have a 100-ohm resistor on DC current, it's still 100 ohms at 1 gigahertz. So that's pure resistance. The other component is reactance. And there's two types of reactance. There's inductive reactance and the opposing capacitive reactance. And those are highly sensitive to the frequencies. If you take a inductor and you give it a DC current, the amount of ohms of impedance is negligible. As you raise the frequency for inductors, you increase the inductive impedance, the inductive reactance, shall we say. Same thing with capacitors. At very high frequencies, capacitors will almost conduct as though it was just a piece of metal. As you lower the frequency, the capacitive reactance increases, and you get reactance that's measured in ohms as well. Let me drop. Then you have a trick of exactly how do you deal with two qualities, because as I've said, it's a complex number. So it's not just the reactance and it's not just the resistance. It's somehow a combination of both of those things. And you can combine them all different ways in your head if you want to. The simplest that I learned was in Cartesian graphs, you know, the X, Y, forget the Z. And for me, Y is the reactance and X is the resistance. And you draw one leg for the reactance, another leg for the resistance, and you draw the hypotenuse. And the hypotenuse is the complex impedance. So when we talk about 50 ohms of impedance, that's what we're talking about. It's a combination of the two. And if you're real tricky, the angle that the hypotenuse makes also gives you information called the phase angle. Well, what's a phase angle? That's the difference between the current and the voltage in the circuit. If you have a purely resistive circuit, the current is always in phase with the voltage. There's no lag, there's no lead. When you introduce things like capacitors, inductors, that goes out the window. And so there's either a lag or there's a lead between the current and the voltage. So that gives you the phase angle. Now, you can do that in Cartesian graphs, but people found it somewhat easier to apply it to a polar coordinate. You ever seen polar graphs? They're circular. Let me drop. Now, a guy, very smart electrical engineer, who happened to be named Smith, he came up with his own little way of maneuvering a chart. And again, it's very difficult to kind of verbally explain it, but it's sort of like a circular graph, but there are two main components. There are straight lines going through the middle of it, and that is the axis for pure resistance. And then there are arcs that kind of sweep up at curves and go higher and higher. Those are both inductive reactants on one side and capacitive reactants on the other side. And then around the edges are markings of all kinds of interesting things, and one of them is angles. And angles also can explain how wavelengths are concerned. And there's one a part of the Smith chart graph that will show you what happens as you rotate an impedance across different lengths of a cable. And it will show you, and it's in the FCC exam, so everyone's gone through this. They ask you, if you have a quarter of a wavelength coaxial cable of 50 ohms, and you short out one end of it, and you measure the other end, what happens? And the answer is it inverts it. So a short on one end looks like an open on the other end. and an open looks like a short. Well, you can actually show that on a Smith chart. You can take the Smith chart and look at the numbers, and as you rotate to a quarter of a wavelength, you'll see that the measurement becomes, for a short, becomes infinity, and for an open becomes zero. And so there are a lot of things that you can do. You could make all kinds of interesting transformations in a Smith chart regarding impedance. There's a series of YouTubes. I'm not exactly sure of the guy's call sign. I think it's W2AEW. He's doing a series on Smith charts that are fascinating. And because he's allowed to show you what it looks like, and you can watch along where he draws the lines and shows you the intercepts and such, it probably makes a lot more sense than what I've just been talking about.
Okay, well, thank you, Roy. I guess one more question about Smith charts is kind of what is the definition of a transmission line? Are we just talking about the coax line itself, or can you think of a transmission line as extending all the way to the feed point of the antenna? If, for example, I also have kind of a tuner and maybe some ladder line or something, going all the way to the antenna.
Okay, usually the way things are termed, and again, it's semantics as opposed to rock hard science, is that antenna system includes the antenna, the balun, the impedance matching circuits, the transmission line, everything going into your driver. That's called an antenna system. When you get to terms like transmission line, usually it does not mean the antenna or the balun or even the antenna tuner. It's purely the wire that transmits the signal from one end to the other. It could be coaxial cable. It could be a ladder line. It can be open wire. There's many different ways of getting the wire. It could be a waveguide even. So all those are transmission lines, but I would not call a antenna tuner a part of a transmission line proper.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'm getting closer to understanding it, and you know, your explanation definitely helped, so I appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome, Chris. And one of these days, if I ever figure out how to make a good article, I'll publicize it. There's also one of the things that I'm having problems trying to figure out how to explain very simply is something called normalization. And normalization is very important in Smith charts because Smith charts are designed with a unit of one, the zero point, if you will, in the middle of the Smith chart is says one. But that's really not terribly helpful. So one of the things that people have to do in order to use it, if they're dealing with a 50-ohm impedance line, is to normalize it by multiplying all the values that they're looking for by 50. So I'm trying to figure out a simple way of explaining what normalization means. That's my best verbal explanation, but I have to come up with something that's more visual for the article. Anyone else out there have any experience or questions or answers about Smith charts? They can be fascinating, but they are not obvious.
Kilo Golf 2, Charlie.
Yes, Milan.
I just wanted to add, I remember when I was studying for my exams, and also in general, I think after the exams, when I actually wanted to understand some of the topics that I just memorized for the extra exam, I was pressed for time and really didn't care very much for everything included in there. One of those topics was Smith charts, really. I learned enough to pass the exam, but then, you know, was curious and wanted to learn a little bit more. So if I remember correctly, George Thomas from Amateur Logic had at least one video, I think maybe even several, where he talks about Smith charts. The only thing is I'm not sure if he did it as part of Amateur Logic or Ham Nation, but he definitely did it in one of those two. I don't think he did it as part of Ham College, because Ham College until recently was just doing the tech exam, and now they've moved on to the general. So it must be either in the amateur logic series or within Ham Nation, where he had one, I think maybe it was two videos on Smith charts, you know, what they are and how to use them. And he actually, in his work, uses them. I forgot exactly his title, but he's sort of a radio engineer and maintains commercial transmitters for, I guess, TV and radio stations, stuff like that. So he actually is familiar with them in practice. So you could check those out. Kilogolf to Charlie, back to that.
Okay, very good, Milan. Yes, what I will do is I will hunt up, again, I think it's, it might be WA2AEW, but I think it's W2AEW. He has a whole series, and I think he's continuing on them, and they're quite extensive. And so, if I find them again, I will give you a email, Chris, and maybe post them someplace for general knowledge as well.
Great, thank you. Yeah, I've definitely poked around YouTube, looking at various people explaining Smith charts. And, you know, it's one of those things that you learn a little bit more each time, and eventually I'm just waiting for it to click is all, I guess.
Yeah, one of the many problems is that the best way that we learn things is by comparison to other ideas that we already have fully understood. And unfortunately, when it comes to things like Smith charts that are based on reactive and resistance and complex numbers and imaginary number lines, there's not a lot of scaffolding available to kind of build on.
It doesn't help that the different types of impedance are sort of something I'm still wrapping my head around too. So a lot to learn. That's the great thing about this hobby, I suppose. KE2A, back to net.
Yeah. It's a whole field of all kinds of things. I mean, ultimately, the problem shouldn't be, I would think, the pure resistance, because almost anyone who's played with electronics at all kind of gets the idea of pure resistance. You know, what gets people into trouble is reactance and the fact that there is both inductive and capacitive reactance. But if you try and keep in mind that one negates the other, and that's the entire concept of resonant circuit, is where the inductive reactance is equal to the capacitive reactance, and it zeroes it out, and you have a tuned circuit, it might be a little bit easy, because instead of, say, three difficult concepts, you bring it down to, say, one and a half difficult concepts. So, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel, and if you don't understand it the first time you see these YouTubes and the explanations, you should try to kind of try it again, because you pick up new stuff with each listening. So I'm sure you'll figure it out. And one of these days I'll figure out a way of presenting it in an article as well. Anyone else want to offer up a question or a comment for the technical net tonight? You don't want me to break into my cricket sound effects, because I do have them now. So please, if anyone has any comments or questions or wants to say something about anything, feel free for this episode of the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net.
Okay, we'll go to Charlie with a technical comment.
Okay, Malin, let us shoot.
Thank you, Roy. Well, I just figured I'll share with the audience what I shared with you via email regarding my antenna problems and how I solved them in case someone else experiences something similar. Because it's not difficult to get in that situation. Basically, my antenna was working fine for many months, and I was very happy with how it works. But then suddenly, I got an error on my amplifier that my SWR is too high. And I was very surprised, because I did not notice my SWR being high on my tuner. So I look, and if I actually transmit continuously for a few minutes, momentarily, just from time to time, it would go from 1.00, what the tuner shows, 5.5 or 5.8, just for moments. But then it started actually being like that for minutes at a time. So obviously something was wrong, and I had to find out what. And that's what I want to talk about. You know, what do you do if something like that happens? The first thing I tried to do is to check the coax, because that was the easiest thing to do. So I removed the switches that were in line with the coax and replaced them with barrel connectors. You know, less likely for the barrel connectors to fail than a switch. I did the same thing with the lightning protection in case the cartridge, you know, had activated and needed replacement or something like that. And I checked the SWR again, and that did not solve it. So on to step two. Let me drop. Okay, step two is now to really take down the antenna, because the problem did not seem to be in the coax. Now, if I had a demi load, there's actually step one and a half that I would have done. I just didn't have a proper demi load for this. Is to connect the whole antenna system, everything except the antenna itself with a balun, but connect a demi load at the end of the coax and to check if I get one-to-one SWR to the demi load. And if it is, then it's definitely not the coax, then it's the balun and the antenna. But I didn't have that, so I just proceeded, you know, to test the balun and the antenna. And that was the next day, and I had a suspicion what the problem is, because it had rained the whole day before, like continuously morning till night. Well, you guys saw it, how much it rained a couple of days ago. So I suspected that either maybe there was some rust on my wire and the connection wasn't very good between the antenna wire and the balun, or water had seeped into the balun. So what I did is I took the balun and I drilled two holes on the bottom part. Now the balun is sealed, but nothing is perfectly sealed, so you know, if you expose it to enough water, it's going to get inside, or also through the temperature changes it's going to condense, and who knows what it gets on and creates a short or whatever. So I let, by drilling the two holes on the bottom, I let, you know, I gave it a way out of there. So, and the second thing I did was I actually properly soldered the antenna wire to the balun and also crimped it and also screwed it on with a wing nut. So it's not going anywhere from there. And it's a good, very good mechanical and electrical connection that way. And lo and behold, after I did these two things, I have not had that problem again. So if you have problems like that, try these things. That's my technical comment for the evening. Back to you, Roy, from Kilo Golf to Charlie.
Very good, Milan. Belt and suspenders are always a good idea. And the moral of the story is the best approach is to take a logical stepwise and isolate as many variables as you can from the equation and see if you can isolate the problem to the smallest number of variables. And in that, Milen did the exact thing. He isolated it to the antenna and the balun and found the problem in the balun. So that's what I always recommend people to do is kind of think of the flow chart of what's going wrong and isolate the components into separate places where you can test for as few variables as possible at a time. And once you find the weak link, you know exactly where you have to go heavy-duty searching. So that was a great example of that, Milan.
Thank you, Roy. I should mention it also helped that I had an accurate SWR meter both on the amplifier and on the tuner, as well as watt meter readings that were in agreement with each other. Because the one thing I didn't mention, you know, there could be a problem with the connectors. And I actually did try to tighten them and check them, you know, connectors from the radio to the amplifier to the tuner to the switch. All of those were checked to be tight as well. And actually maybe might not be a bad practice to check this periodically, because somehow they managed to get loose if you use the standard PL259s.
Yes, I agree. Every so often, I will kind of go to the back of the boxes and tighten things up. About 90-95% of them are reasonably tight, but there's always a few that come loose. And for some odd reason, I've noticed that SMAs tend to loosen much faster than 259. So I don't know exactly if there's a reason for that or just my particular SMA connectors.
Oh, it could be your particular SMA connectors, or maybe, you know, the cable is putting pressure on it. I don't know if you move your equipment around a lot or not. I've had very good luck with BNCs, because at least with the connectors I use, it seems that the cable is allowed to twist freely because, you know, of the way the BNC connector is made. It kind of gives it a little bit of stress relief for the twisting if you use BNCs. Unfortunately, most equipment does not come with a BNC connector, which is a pity because it's a very nice connector as long as you don't get into really high power or really high frequency, in which case you'd want an end connector anyway. Kilogolf to Charlie, back to Roy.
Yes, they all use bayonet spring-loaded devices. That's why they're not screwed in, so you'd have to push them in and then twist in order to loosen them. So they're very good for instant connections, and I know people who use them as a converting adapter on their handy talkie so they could pop out one antenna and pop in another. They find it less cumbersome than screwing an SMA connector onto it. But BNCs and the B in BNC, unfortunately, does not stand for bayonet, but that's bayonet is what they call that interesting little gizmo. Any other comments, questions, answers about figuring out what goes wrong? Because we've all been there, and we'll all be there again if we continue in this hobby. So it's nice that we share with each other.
KE2A, I have a similar story.
Yes, tell the group.
This was, I think, a couple weekends ago. It was, I put up a dipole that, or it's kind of a doublet configuration that I've used plenty of times and never really had any issues. And I was getting sort of periodic high SWR on, I think it was 20, and the doublet is resonant on 20, so I was really confused and ended up sort of just basically deciding to pack everything up. And as I'm breaking down everything, because this is an antenna that I deploy sort of on demand, and as I'm breaking down everything, sure enough, there was just one loose connector on the ladder line on one side of the ballon. And goes to show, check those connections, make sure they're all tight. Because just one loose one obviously can drive you a little crazy.
Yes, indeed. That's one thing about the laws of physics. They don't let you get away. They don't grade on a curve, if you will. You either fulfill their laws or they bite you in the backside.
The thing that surprised me about this, though, was that, you know, I was able to tune, but then it would sort of become detuned. So something new to me, and now I know to check those ballon connections.
Okay, so you learned a very valuable lesson. And one thing that I keep telling people is I can appreciate why the concept of a matched impedance and a one-to-one standing wave ratio is like the ultimate goal. But you have to keep in mind that dummy loads offer you a one-to-one impedance match, but you certainly don't want to transmit on a dummy load. So although a matched impedance allows for the maximum amount of energy transfer, you still have to deal with what that energy transfer does on your chosen radiator. If it's a non-resonant radiator, it just heats stuff up. It has to be resonant or tuned to resonance in order to radiate off of the wire and put out those lovely little radio waves that everyone wants to use to transmit to everyone. So efficiency, takeoff angle, ground loss, insertion loss, all these factors unfortunately have to be kept in mind in addition to a standing wave ratio. My PALSTAR, God love it, it can tune a doorknob, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to try and talk to someone on my doorknob.
Comment?
Yes, Milan.
Speaking of energy transfer and conversion into heat, something interesting I've been noticing now that I have an amplifier with even more power than before. on 80 meters, where my antenna is too short and not very resonant, and where the tuner needs to do a fair bit of work. Although I have the same PowerStar tuner as you, so it is no problem for the tuner, but I know they are, you know, the coax is also good because it's LMR 400. But after all, the Anan, you know, does not handle infinite amounts of power, especially mismatched, even though the one I have is rated at 5 kilowatts, so it does well. But there's no such thing as you know, constant SWR for me. I can start transmitting at 1.00 on the amplifier, but within 15 seconds, I will gradually go to 1.25 SWR as things heat and things change along the way, probably mostly in the Anna, because that's where the impedance transformation really happens, not so much in the other components. So it's interesting to watch, and I guess I've been a lot more careful about tuning now. That I've noticed these changes as I increase the power. Kilo Golf 2, Charlie, back to that.
Yeah, very interesting. It could be the balance. The ferrites can be sensitive to thermal changes, and in severe cases, they've been known to heat up so much that they actually change their magnetic qualities and become inefficient as the balance that they were meant to be. But a lot of times they're reversible. You cool them down a little bit, and they function just as well as the day that you bought them.
That's exactly what happens, because it's very easy to observe with ST8, where your duty cycle is you transmit for 15 seconds and you listen for 15 seconds. So every transmission, I would always start at 1.00, and every transmission I would end at exactly 1.25 SWR, and every transmission is like that. Basically, that's the heating for the 15 seconds, and another 15 seconds lets it cool down to 1-to-1, basically. So it works fine for my needs. It's just I was a little surprised when I suddenly saw my SWR creep up like that, because I'm not used to doing that when I'm operating with you know, less power. But now that I could actually use more power, I noticed it. Okay, back to you, Roy. It was off to Charlie.
Well, I mean, you have two different situations. Now that you're using a kilowatt of power and you're using a modality that has a 100% duty cycle for short bursts, so you're using a lot of energy on those balun. I guess the next time you buy a balun, you'll have to get one rated for 10 kilowatts.
Actually, I was using only 300 watts or so. I did speak to the importer for these tuners, and for these amplifiers, sorry, and they really don't recommend you to run 1 kilowatt, even though it can. It won't be good for all the equipment. So I did only 300 watts, but yeah, it is the constant carrier that does this. I'm not sure why I didn't notice it before, I guess, because the tube amplifier really doesn't care for, you know, such numbers as 1.25 SWR. But the solid state definitely notices it. All right, back to you, Roy. Kilo Golf 2 Charlie.
AC2GS. Well, you learn something new every day. Anyone else have any comments or questions regarding this field? Is there anyone who has come late to the party and has a question or a comment for the Technical Net? Also, keep in mind that we do have the TechNet puzzle for today, and as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, it's a little bit tricky. Matter of fact, it's a lot tricky. So probably when you read the question and the answers, you should probably immediately discount your first answer and go looking for a second answer. But we'll get to that when we run out of people asking questions. I hope we haven't at this point. Is there anyone out there with any questions or comments for the Technical Net tonight? Okay, everyone wants to be shy. Let me read the TechNet puzzle for today. The question is, the field strength from a UHF antenna is measured at a distance of 20 meters over clear ground. At twice that distance, the measurement will be A, much the same value, B, about half the first value, C, approximately quartered, and finally D, impossible to predict. So that's the question about how does a field strength meter results change when you double the distance? Anyone out there want to take a guess at this?
KE2A.
Yes, Chris.
I'm going to guess it's a quarter based on the inverse square law.
And that would be a very good guess if this was a question that wasn't a trick question that expected people to make that very good educated guess. So, Chris, if you couldn't pick C, quartered, what would be your second favorite answer?
Probably the answer that said it's impossible to know.
Okay, what about your third favorite answer?
I suppose a half, then.
Congratulations. Okay, let me explain this, because it's incredibly non-obvious. Because we kind of think about field strength. Well, we don't really think about field strength. That's the problem. We think about power. And we've learned that electromagnetism and gravity deal with an inverse square law, as you mentioned. And so if you double the distance from a energy source, if it's electromagnetism or if it's gravity, you will decrease the power to one-fourth by doubling it. So it's inverse square. The problem is that field strength isn't the power. Field strength is actually measured in volts per meter. And whereas power is measured in watts. And the best explanation that I could offer people is that it's sort of like a perfect resistive circuit. If you have a 100-ohm resistor on a DC circuit and you double the resistance, it does a bunch of things. It drops the power, the watts, to one-quarter. It follows an inverse square law. But much like field strength, voltage per meter, it only halves the voltage. So unfortunately, although power is an inverse square law, field strength for electromagnetic waves is a inverse linear law. So the answer is it halves it. Again, not obvious, totally a trick question starting off, and I hope at least everyone will kind of remember what a field strength reading sort of means the next time it pops up in, you know, the situation. Anyone have any questions or comments or statements about field strength meters or inverse square laws or inverse linear laws? Okay. Anyone with any other comments, questions, statements, or anything to kind of fill the space here? Because, I don't know, it's a sleepy day in Brooklyn.
Kilo Golf 2, Charlie.
Yes, Milan.
Well, since no one has questions, I figured I'll add something else. I learned it a while ago, but it is useful. And actually, as a newcomer to the hobby, it was not obvious. You know how people tell you that you have to waterproof your PL259 SO, 212, whatever it was, connectors, the UHF connectors? Well, the cheapest way to do it is with electrical tape, obviously. And what they don't tell you is how to do it, and how to do it without getting it sticky, because what I've seen in many videos, and what that was my first attempt, is to just start wrapping the connector with the electrical tape, with the sticky part towards the connector, and that seemed to make sense. But then I watched a guy who seems to do this professionally, and he actually did it the exact opposite way. He started wrapping it around with the sticky part out, and actually I realized, hey, that's smart. It still sticks to itself, because, you know, you do several layers of this, but it doesn't get your connector all sticky, and if you need to disconnect this connector and connect it somewhere else, it won't be all gummed up from the glue. So that's smart. I mean, there's other solutions for it. You can certainly buy other sealant materials that won't get it sticky, but, you know, that's an easy way to do it. And then if you want, you can, you know, after you've done a layer or two like that with the sticky part facing out of the electrical tape, you can wrap a layer or two with the sticky part facing and without getting your connector sticky. So that's my advice for today. Back to you, Roy. We'll go to Charlie.
AC2GR. So thank you very much, Milan. And that's a very good method. There are probably more methods of weatherproofing your splice almost than there are amateur radio operators. I have seen many different combinations of things. Usually there's a lot of talk about that tarry coaxial material. Once you get it on, you'll never get it off. Other people kind of like the self-fusing silicone. The problem with self-fusing silicones, though, is they're very sensitive to abrasion. You just have to slit those things, and they just pop away. So what then people do is, after they've coated it in the silicone fusing tape, they cover that with the electrical tape. But I've seen people who do that and, in addition, still feel the need for something, and they take some clear lacquer and they spray over the whole thing. The latest and greatest permutation that I have read about was in QEX. A gentleman actually took the trouble of making all of these splices and dunking them in a water basin for a month and then figuring out how much water got absorbed and how the impedance got changed using a time domain reflectometer. And then he took these things apart. And his opinion was that whenever you wrap tape, there are these little gaps with the interface of one tape covering the next tape that act as a kind of a capillary function. If you have enough water on the outside, capillary action will draw the water into the splice. So what he came up with is a rather interesting novel approach that I've started to use. He takes a half-inch heat-shrink tubing that is glued on the inside, and he simply puts it in the splice, heats it up uniformly, and the whole thing seals without any kind of ridges that have capillary action. And so far it seems to be working, but again, every day someone comes up with a different way of weatherproofing. And then there are people out there who don't like the concept of weatherproofing because they feel that it's trapping moisture in, and so they like to have some kind of a draining opening on their system. So, you know, it's one of those great things that everyone has their own answer to this question. And I'd be interested if anyone out there has any novel approaches to weatherproofing their splices.
Roy, the guy I watched, actually, he did first the electrical tape with the sticky part facing out, then he did silicone tape, and then he did the electrical tape facing in, if I remember, and that looked very, very sturdy to me, at least. And actually, the submersion test would have capillary action, but I'm not sure. It's just getting rained outside, you know, the regular rain would have that much capillary action as him having it submerged for a moment. So, of course, nothing wrong with overdoing it, but I don't think there's such need to overdo it. Just personal opinion. I don't have a long-term observation on this since I've been in the hobby for a short time. But that, I guess that's why there's so many opinions on the topic, because it's kind of hard to observe it, really, and test for it. He'll go through Charlie back to that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the many problems is, do you torture test it or do you just test it over time? The trouble with testing it over time, although it's much more consistent with normal responses, is that it can take years and years and years for it to develop. Whereas if you torture it for a month, then you can wind up your entire experiment in 6 weeks and you're done with it. So I can appreciate either end. It just... It seems a a very simple approach to just slide some heat shrink tubing, hit it with a heat gun, and calling it a day. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if anyone does any further studies, because he tested that approach with his basin and found that it pretty much was the driest splice that he was coming up with. But, you know, whatever floats anyone's boat, I'm more than happy to hear of any novel approaches. You know, three layers of tape is probably a good thing, but sometimes too many layers of tape can cause their own problems. So anyone out there have any war stories of splices that went bad or particular splices they're particularly pleased with? You can go on HF arguing whether crimp is better than solder, and some people crimp and then solder, you know, again, belt and suspenders. I find that a lot of professionals seem to have moved on to crimping, and so I'm a little bit used to crimping. A lot of my connectors require that you solder the center line, but otherwise I've had pretty good success crimping the outer shield. I think especially if you don't do it a lot, getting the right timing to solder the outer shield without melting the insulator, it can be problematic. And if you crimp it, you get rid of that entire variable. So I'm a guy who's for crimping, but you'll find a lot of people who are very, very strong, emotional about soldering everything. Okay, well, this has been an interesting episode of the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Net. Let me ask if anyone has any further questions or comments or statements before I wrap it up for this week.
KE2A with another question.
Chris, fire away.
Well, I was thinking about S meters recently, and you know, this is going back to sort of the question of how we measure things, and also thinking about Moen was mentioning FT8 earlier, and I wonder why, you know, I just think that giving a signal to noise reading in decibels would be a really useful thing to exchange over the air instead of S meter readings. And, of course, our SDRs can probably do that in software. And, you know, just wonder why we don't move to that.
Among many reasons, it's what people are used to, and they feel comfortable. And sometimes I have this conversation on the air that S-meters are all relative readings, and they depend a great deal on the particular manufacturer's standard for calibrating it, if they calibrate it at all, and also whether these things have been calibrated in any way in a couple of years, and they are moving all over the place. But there's a way of sort of indicating what S-meter readings really mean. Theoretically, every S unit is 6 dB of gain. So in other words, if you quadruple your power, I should be able to look on my machine and see that it's one entire S unit improved. So that's a decibel reading. You just have to translate it, assuming that your S meter is properly calibrated. For the most part, people who have a software-defined radio have self-calibrated S meters. They're kind of plugged in with software, so you don't have to play any games. The people who have old legacy systems, it could be calibrated in any fashion imaginable. They may make one S unit 3 decibels instead of 6, and it could vary according to the last time it was calibrated. There are other ways of recording your signal. You could do dBm for milliwatts, for milliwatts, and then you're giving an absolute signal of how many microwatts you're receiving. My Flex 6700 is capable of reading in dBm. So you could use S units, you could use dBm, but most people end up using S units, and they seem to think of them as the same. They take a very strange approach to S units. An S0 does not mean that there's no noise. It's just the noise is at a particular calibrated level that the equipment was set for S0. So that, you know, decibels, you know, a zero decibel sound is not a silent sound. It's a given acoustical sound. So it's a problem understanding how logarithms work.
Yeah, I'm jealous of your Flex because, you know, I have the ICOM 7300, which I like very much, but the way that they have designed their S meter is that S9 is accurate, but it's a 3 dB scale. And so I wish that they would just fix that in firmware.
They should be able. My only guess is it's a marketing ploy, because it makes no sense to me, and it's probably all in software. So if enough people want it, then it'll happen. The problem is everyone's S meter readings will drop, and there'll be a lot of yelling and screaming at ICOM. So it's kind of S meter inflation at work.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is they could offer these things as options, right, as menu selectable options if they wanted. It'd be nice if they did. You know, I laugh when people give readings out of like 20 over S9 because the amount of power that if that reading was accurate, the amount of power that the person would actually be receiving is kind of mind-boggling.
Well, it depends. I mean, I have some neighbors who are fellow club members, and when they put the pedal to the metal, I get semi-ridiculous numbers on my device. But reasonable, considering that he's throwing out 500-600 watts a block away from me. I think it's a shame when they rig S meters to just make people feel better about themselves. I mean, that's kind of a foolish waste of effort. There is no place where there is any suggestion that S units should be at 3 decibel units each. There's some question of what you set the S0 for, and the standard practice is to set the amount of microwatts to be different on the UHF-VHF band for S0 as opposed to HF bands. But I don't think there's any consensus of changing the 6 decibel per S unit. But, you know, it's a shame that marketers have to do that. And that's one of the many reasons why if you ever pick up an issue of QST, you will never see an ad that mentions the antenna gain, because QST decided in their wisdom that antenna gain figures are pretty much calculated by the marketing department and don't really correlate with anything in reality. So at least we don't have to deal with make-believe antenna gain. I wish they would do the same thing with S meter results.
We'll go to Charlie.
Yes, Milan.
Just wanted to mention, even if it's not properly calibrated or linearly or, you know, up for what S0 is, useful. Especially we use this often during the 10 meter net. At least when I was able to hear people, you know, I could if I have a constant noise level by stating what my noise level is and telling several stations what S meter reading I have for them, they can get a relative idea of their signal strength to me. So in relative terms and practical terms, it is useful that way. Now, that's not, you know, lab-grade accuracy, but that's rarely needed. And used this way, it's kind of similar to the signal-to-noise ratio, which is another thing that SDRs typically can show you. Even my $100 unit, the SDR Play RSP1 Alpha, has dBs and it has a signal-to-noise ratio as well, which is very useful, to compare different signals. All right, back to you, Roy. We'll go to Charlie.
I agree. Any information is better than no information. But the ultimate thing, even with a well-calibrated S meter, I think not everyone appreciates that these are all relative numbers. You can't mix your S meter readings with Joe's S meter readings because you're not quite sure of all the other variables involved. So when people ask about S-meters readings, I sort of understand, especially if they're comparing their signal from one person to another person, and they're working on the same receiver with the same set of numbers. But it's kind of confusing to me how they transfer your S-meter receiver results with another guy's S-meter results and another guy's S-meter results, and they sort of think of them as equivalent amounts of power when that's not necessarily so. So the problem is that in relative terms, it's an excellent gauge of how signals are getting out. But they're not absolute numbers. They shouldn't be used as absolute numbers or even thought of as absolute numbers. Otherwise, it's comparing apples and oranges, if you will.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It is relative to what you measure without changing anything else in your measurement. For example, as you were talking, I was seeing S9 on my radio here. But if I press the preamp button, I see S9 plus 10. Well, did you suddenly increase your power by 10 decibels? No, of course not. It's just what I'm measuring changed because I changed things at my own station. Similarly, if I use a different radio, I might measure you differently with the different radio because it's set differently. So it is all relative to the same standard. And you have to keep that in mind. You can't really mix and match measurements from different stations. Unless everyone had perfectly calibrated equipment, that is calibrated exactly the same way and is set up with the same RF gain and has similar circuitry. Or everyone's using SDRs that are, many SDRs do try to provide calibrated readings that you actually can compare between radios, and those are in DBM or in DB. Back to you, Roy, from Kilo Golf 2 Charlie.
Yes, usually SDRs are somewhat decent in that if you increase the gain, they sort of know that you're increasing the gain, and they adjust the S number accordingly. In legacy systems, one of the biggest confusing things when I just opened my IC7100 is when I realized that by tweaking the RF gain, I could bring the background S unit number all the way up. It was sort of amazing to me, and I didn't quite understand it until I Googled the subject and found about how a lot of legacy radios sort of cheat by taking a signal from the automatic gain circuit to fathom what the S unit should be, and they are so easily confused that you can pretty much adjust my 7100 to any S unit baseline noise that you want to. It's kind of weird. And I would think that people would complain about that because it sort of negates most values of S units if you can adjust them so easily.
E2A, you've hit on another annoyance of mine.
Tell us.
That's exactly that, and that, you know, just depending on my preamp setting, it's giving me a different S meter reading. I just think it's ridiculous. And, in an ideal world, we'd all be handing out signal-to-noise readings.
I agree. Unfortunately, there would be a whole bunch of people who would be upset with the results, but I always believe in accurate numbers, even if they don't tell glowing reports. I prefer accurate, correct information to delusional information. So I would agree with you. I think one of the things I really like, well, I like a lot of things about my lovely little 6700. I wish the guys who did the software worked a little bit harder. But I like the S signals are not that erratic and imaginary. I usually use them as a good relative rule of thumb of people's signals to me. Any other questions or comments, either about S units or anything else, for this episode of the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net? Okay, very well. I want to thank everyone who participated, and especially you, Chris. I got almost a feeling that it's me, Malen, and you, Chris. But hopefully next time more people will come by and participate, because otherwise I'd just be talking to myself. But let me just ask one last time before we roll the curtain down. Anyone have any comments, questions, or answers for the technical mess before we call today?
Hey, E2A, I just wanted to thank you, Roy, for doing the TechNet and keeping it going. It's great to have more options in terms of good technical discussions on the air. So thanks again. And 73, KE2A.
K2RI, Dick.
How are you, Dick?
Pretty good, Roy. Too bad I checked in so late. Didn't hear the beginning of the net. I also see that there's some delay between what goes into this machine and what comes back out of it. I guess there's a delay line in there to negate the PL tones. Is that true? K2RIW.
We're using a Yaesu Fusion digital repeater, and it is my understanding that for some bizarre reason, it massages the audio in the digital domain for a while before it lets it go analog. So that's probably what's introducing the delay.
Understand. I'm adjusting my antenna aiming direction. I guess I got a little bit quieter when I did that. Did you guys get into any RF or radio frequency biohazard in the last few weeks, or is that something not come up yet? Over to you.
No, we haven't done biohazard. We were doing kind of simple things about S-meters and weatherproofing cables, and we talked about Smith charts, and for the life of me, I'm having problems explaining that without a lot of illustration.
That Smith chart is a very useful thing, but the first couple of hours that a person's exposed to it, it certainly can be confusing. One of the subject, with reference to S-meters, the way some rigs are designed, when you turn the RF gain control down, the machine is wired in such a way that it injects a higher negative voltage into the S-meter circuit. Yes, that does cut down the gain, and it'll make you responsive to only strong signals, but it also makes the S-meter go up, and you can recognize the fact that the rising S-meter and the quietness have got this peculiar relationship. You don't hear background as much anymore. Bye-bye.
Yes, I actually mentioned that. My first base station was an ICOM 7100, and out of the box, that was one of the first things that confused the heck out of me. And matter of fact, that was probably my first question that I sent John for his mailbag. I mean, I researched and I figured out what had gone wrong, but I thought it was such an interesting, weird thing that I shared the question with John, and he actually mentioned it on one of the technical nets.
Which John is that that we're speaking about here now, Roy?
KC2WGB, may he rest in peace.
Oh, that John. Yes. Good old John Beck. And so I think you're saying he had a pretty good explanation for what was happening?
No, it's, I was kind of feeling, he wasn't really getting that much questions during one summer, I recall. And so I decided to salt the mailbag a little bit and send him some questions. And I sent him answers along with the questions just because I'm difficult that way. But he liked the questions enough that he asked them to you. He didn't mention my answers, which I guess was a good idea. And he just used them for the technical net. Because one summer I went from a fellow towards the beginning of the summer. And by the end of the summer, he had used my questions so often, he says, it's Roy again.
How about that? So you're saying he did really eventually identify you. And I'm kind of curious as to what was really going on when at times he would get 74 letters per week to his mailbag. My goodness, that's an awful big number. I wonder if that was real. Go ahead.
I don't know. I think that was maybe a slightly tall tale or a very, very unusual week. He also used to invite high school students into his lab and give them little demonstrations, and a lot of times the questions sounded like they came from a high school type kid. So I think he had more of an interaction with them than I do, and so that's one of the reasons why. And you know, I have an ongoing theory that amateur radio operators really do not care for electronic mail. When I first got into this hobby, I was very confused and repeatedly tested my mail server because I knew for a fact that I was missing all these emails from my new fellow hams until I realized that my fellow hams really didn't want to email me.
Oh, did you ever get a chance to visit John's lab?
No, unfortunately, I didn't. I kind of asked, and he kind of told me right then he was busy, and I accepted that and moved on. But this was long before he got sick, but he was a very, very busy man, and he was a very, very private man, so I understood.
I presume you did see the pictures of his lab that were on QRZ.com. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Well, not only do I have I seen the pictures, but when he passed away, I bought a bird watt meter that he owned, and it has a place of honor at my shack. And also, because of the pictures that I saw of his shack on QRZ, I have my own little Wilmhurst generator. We had a little fun comment back and forth when I told him that I had a Wilmhurst generator. He told me very proudly that he had an 11-inch Wilmhurst generator, and I unfortunately told him that mine's 12 inches.
Was that true? Was yours really 12 inches in diameter of the discs?
Yep, that's what it say, and that's what it looks like, 12 inches.
What brand is that, Roy, and where did you buy it? How many dollars?
It's a United Scientific Supplies Incorporated, and I probably spent too many dollars.
Is that science supply company that's in the Buffalo, New York area?
I don't think so. I think they're in Quahog.
What state or what country is that?
Illinois.
Okay. What's the biggest air gap you've ever gotten a spark to go across with that machine?
Well, it's always better in the winter than it is in the summer because it really doesn't like the high humidity. The most that I was able to crank it up with was about a little bit over an inch, about an inch and a quarter. We talked about this once. I think it might have been on John's wake, and you mentioned that putting the electrodes in an asymmetrical pattern would give me a wider spark. I tried that, but I really couldn't squeeze any more length out of the spark.
Interesting. We'll have to discuss that further someday. I'm not going to hold you up any longer. Nice meeting you on this net, and I presume this is called the technical net. Is that true?
Yes, we call this the Kings County Radio Club's technical question and answer net.
And these are also recorded on the email, on the website, I believe. And so at some time in a few days, this one will appear on that website. Is that true?
I don't have to rely on good old Mike number one, so they'll be on the website in about a half hour.
How about that? I thank you. I'm going to go away for now. Bye-bye. And let's see now. Live well and prosper. What is it that Spock used to say? Live long and prosper.
Yes, that's a fine Vulcan sentiment.
Bye-bye for now, Roy. KQRIW.
AC2GS. Thank you very much for visiting, Dick. You're always welcome here. So, anyone else have any questions or comments or statements before we shut it down for the night?
Sure, Yankee 2, Michael Yankee, comment?
Yes, Gene.
Just want to say that I was on the side listening, and I had nothing to contribute, but I'm here listening, supporting the net, supporting you.
Thank you very much, Gene. I do appreciate that.
Kilo Golf 2, Charlie.
Yes, Milan.
Just wanted to mention, I started looking for the generator that you mentioned. It is available for $125 online without shipping. And it's 12.4 inches in diameter discs. So you are correct that your discs were bigger than his discs.
Well, I didn't want to be overly boastful. How do you like that as a reason why I didn't go with the four-tenths of an inch extra? But I don't know. It just struck me as aesthetically pleasing. And if there's only one thing better than creating sparks of electricity, it's doing it with aesthetics as well.
Berlin, well, what's the website you found it at, Berlin?
It's interesting because you can't exactly tell what it does just by looking at it unless you know what it does.
That's quite true. I mean, it looks like it belongs in some kind of Dr. Frankenstein's lab, though. It has that kind of Baroque look to it.
Imagine a wall-sized version. Yes, that would definitely belong there.
I think if you need something bigger, you just trade it up for a Van de Graaff generator. Because those, I have seen Wilmhurst devices hooked up to motors with belts, and so you don't have to crank them yourself. But I think it's I don't know. I think it's endearing to crank it up to get to the sparks rather than just flipping a switch, because the motors on these things are damn noisy. Okay, Doug, maybe someday I'll do an article about my Wilmhurst generator. They're fun little toys to have. I bought plasma balls when they first came out. Gosh, it must have been in the 1980s, and I was endlessly fascinated by plasma globes and such.
I've never had one of those, but I will probably eventually buy one of them. I discovered my wife is also interested in them. And maybe we'll get something one day.
Well, with plasma globes, they've kind of gone really down in price, except for the very big ones. China kind of chugs them out. They sell some that are small enough that you could plug into a USB port, and it takes the 5 volts, and it does everything that the big ones do, except in a little teeny package.
Hey, China. Well, they sure do bring the prices down. Yeah, and sometimes the quality. Kilo Golf 2 Charlie, back to you, Roy.
Well, you know, it's like MFJ. If you're not that interested in high quality, it's a great way of saving a couple of bucks. So I appreciate it when you can get things inexpensive. You have to wait a long time because it's the veritable slow boat from China. But I certainly have saved money on little motorized thingies and lighting systems and all manner of tchotchkes. So, as long as you're not expecting German engineering, it's a very inexpensive way of buying these things, the Chinese.
Yeah, that's true. I actually buy a lot of, cheap connectors and things like that from there that I don't need for very high precision or too much power, they were fine.
Yeah, I have a feeling that the quality is slowly inching up. I mean, I've told this story far too many times, but I remember as a kid the junk that had Made in Japan stamped on it. And, you know, back then they were selling recycled tin cans as toys. So now it's just a vague memory for some of us. So you never know what the China will slowly rise its quality, and maybe it'll be just as good as Japanese consumer goods one of these days. Not quite yet, but maybe one of these days. Okay, one final shout-out. Anyone have any questions, comments, statements, or what have you for the technical net for tonight before I shut this down and lock it all up? This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, March 7th, sometime after 7:30 p.m. We offer a pre-meeting technical question and answer session much like this net, from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. as time allows. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater KC2RC. If you can communicate using Fusion technology, please join in. We offer an audio stream of the Fusion Net on internet at stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. An application is available on our website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this TechNet, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen more and talk a little less. Well, it's time to roll this all up and shut this all down now, but we'll be back to do it all over again on March 14th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, and especially to Malen, KG2C. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Good night, guys. Until the next time.
Good night, Roy, 7-3 from Kilo Golf 2 Charlie.
Good night, Roy. Yankee 2, Mega Yankee.
Thanks, Roy, and good night. KE2A, Chris in Brooklyn.